Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, reading from True West, October 2021 edition. Pulp Redemption by Johnny D. Boggs and the editors of True West. From dime novels to museums, Western pulp art and illustration has reached its zenith. A.R. Mitchell drifted into the office of Cowboy Stories magazine in the late 1920s with a painting to show editor Harold Hersey. "Mr. Hersey, I've tried to paint the real cowboy," Hersey recalled the artist saying, "not the movie variety." The painting appeared on the magazine's January 1927 cover, launching Mitchell's career and inspiring Hersey to write of Mitchell in the issue's editor's notebook, "He refuses to compromise for the sake of popularity. But like all sincere and great painters, he will get the popularity he does not seek." Illustrators certainly influenced pulp art, says Allison Shoemaker, executive director of the A.R. Mitchell Museum in Trinidad, Colorado, which celebrates its 40th anniversary with the fundraising ball October 2nd. "I think Western illustration was the foundation for Western pulp art," Shoemaker said. "The art on the cover of pulp magazines is what drew the reader in. It is the reason the publication was purchased." But did great illustrators become great artists because of their illustrative careers, or were they great artists to begin with? Take Maynard Dixon, the iconic Southwestern artist and member of the Society of Illustrators Hall of Fame. Dixon, says Mark Sublett, owner of Tucson's Medicine Man Art Gallery, said he learned more about being a fine artist by working for the large San Francisco advertising firm Foster Kleiser than during any other training. His illustrative legacy continues its roots through today's successful crop of contemporary Western artists who channel his sense of color, strong lines, and powerful composition in their fine art paintings of the modern West. Early illustrators weren't all men. Mary Halleck Foote was an author and illustrator for many publications and became one of the renowned women illustrators of the 1870s and 1880s. Her realistic depictions of landscapes in Idaho, Colorado, and California helped shape the American view of the Far West as a prospective home for women and men, historian Chris N. says. Frederick Remington's first illustration was done as a Yale student for the Yale Courant. By the 1880s, he was established as an illustrator. But, says Laura Desmond, curator of the Frederick Remington Art Museum in Ogdensburg, New York, he learned quickly that in the minds of the critics, there was a divide between illustration work and fine art. And though he had received some early critical accolades and exhibited his work at least annually throughout his career, his prodigious production of illustration work had to some extent pigeonholed him as a mere illustrator in the eyes of the critics, something that he worked hard to overcome. That hadn't changed during the golden era of the American illustrator, 1900 to 1930, which produced a number of successful artists, including W. Herbert Dunton, Frank Schoonover, Philip R. Goodwin, and W.H.D. Kerner. Dunton gave up his career as an illustrator when he moved to Taos in 1915, says Michael R. Grouser, McClaslin Chair of Cowboy Culture and Curator of Cowboy Collections and Western Art at Oklahoma City's National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum. Goodwin's work appeared everywhere, but nobody knew his name. He's the most famous artist nobody ever heard of. Kerner and Schoonover suffered from the illustrator's curse, a bunch of nonsense cooked up by art historians who basically said illustrators were a bunch of hired hacks. Rene A. Dantes, archivist at the Panhandle Plains Historical Museum in Canyon, Texas, points to N.C. Wyeth. He is especially interesting because he was noted for being very aware of the limitations of painting versus illustration, Dantes says. The printing processes at the time were limiting to an artist's imagination. Frequently, a modest color palette restricted the way ideas could be presented. Years after the Golden Era, Frank C. McCarthy made a name for himself by having his paintings appear on the covers of myriad Louis L'Amour novels. An illustrator is a fine artist who has to design paintings of a given subject matter around the typesetting of a page or double page, cover, or ad layout for publication, McCarthy told Western novelist Elmer Kelton for Kelton's The Art of Frank C. McCarthy, 1992. Most painters from that time immemorial have made their livings doing commissions of given subject matter. On that list, you'll find Albert Bierstadt, Frank Tenney, Johnson, and Thomas Moran. Books today, of course, still need cover art. There are plenty of book cover artists today, but most of their work graces the covers of bodice busters or Western fantasy books, Grauer says. While there were plenty of cliches during the Golden Age, today they just seem to be cookie cutter or wash, rinse, repeat. But some publishers are making headway. At Blackstone Publishing, lead designer Catherine English says capturing a specific mood communicates what the book is about. And these days, high-profile names are common in the illustrative world. Dantas points to Ed Mell and Billy Schneck. Opinions of illustrators, of course, have changed. Just like Schneck, a protege of Andy Warhol, a fashion illustrator who didn't touch Westerns until his Elvis paintings of 1962 and several serigraphs in 1986. Schneck and Mell arrived in New York around the same time. When I came up, New York was the happening contemporary scene, and I perceived myself as a contemporary artist, Schneck says. I was such a snob, being a New York City artist. I had utter disdain for illustrators. I thought these were just second and third tier artists who are wannabe artists. As the decades rolled along, I thought, wow, these illustrators did some pretty fantastic work. And after they became fine artists, they did even greater work. It was kind of a coming to Jesus meeting with illustrators. And now for years, I've been using movie stills as a basis for a lot of my art. So yeah, those illustrators, they're pretty good. The Golden West. Rennard Strickland's cinema collection at Scottsdale's Museum of the West. Rennard Strickland, who died January 5th at the age of 80, is lauded as a champion of American Indian rights and American Indian law. A Muskogee, Oklahoma native of Osage and Cherokee heritage, Strickland served as dean of several law schools and introduced Indian law into the University of Oklahoma's Law Center's curriculum. But Strickland was also an art philanthropist and collector of movie ephemera. Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West, honors that legacy with an exhibit titled Dr. Rennard Strickland's Profound Legacy, The Golden West on the Silver Screen, which debuted May 28th. The exhibit, a celebration of Strickland's love for Western films and art, includes rare Western and Indian movie posters and lobby cards that date from the 1890s to the mid-1980s. We hope what people will get out of this is an appreciation for Dr. Strickland and what a remarkable philanthropist he was, says Tricia Losher, Assistant Museum Director and Chief Curator. He really brings a perspective that is unique because he interprets these posters as a critical reading and gives insight, not only to the Western films, directors, and actors, but also an analysis of where we were in history based on the films. Quotes from Strickland's colleagues are posted throughout the exhibit. In 2016, Western Spirit and the Arizona State University Foundation were gifted more than 5,000 posters and lobby cards, and the Rennard Strickland Collection of Western Film History ran at Western Spirit June 20th, 2017 through September 23rd, 2018. Estimated value of the entire collection, $6 million. Blood on the Green Cloth by Peter Brand. Fighting for the Faroe Dollar, Johnny Tyler and Tombstone's Gambler's War. In the summer of 1880, Tombstone, Arizona territory was a silver-rich boomtown. And while mining companies and citizens fought legal battles over claim boundaries and town lots, another battle would be waged in the saloons and gambling halls. This struggle was between saloon men, professional gamblers, and hard cases, all eager to gain a bigger share of the almighty gambling dollar. Gambling was big business in most mining towns, and the sporting men who held their nerve, fleecing miners, cowboys, and professionals at their tables, stood to make the lion's share of the profits. In late July 1880, the most lavishly appointed saloon and gambling room ever seen in Tombstone was opened to the public by Milt Joyce and his partner, William Parker. The saloon was named the Oriental, and it boasted a polished bar with a chandelier and fine furniture and fixtures. The attached gambling room was carpeted in a plush style, aimed to make the clientele as comfortable as possible while they competed with the house. Faro was the most popular card game at the time, and Joyce and his partner offered at least three tables on opening night. The Oriental immediately became the talk of the town, and shortly after its opening night, the Tombstone epitaph noted the arrival of several new gamblers, referred to as sporting men. Johnny Tyler was one of those professional gamblers who had heard of Tombstone's riches and decided to stake a claim. His arrival just happened to coincide with the opening of the Oriental and would spark ongoing acts of violence that developed due to fierce competition for the faro profits being generated in Tombstone. Disputes between gamblers were not uncommon on the frontier, and in Tombstone, two factions known as the Slopers and the Easterners would face off against the Green Cloth. Tyler was a certified sloper. The term was used to describe men who hailed from the west of the Pacific Slope and almost universally had been schooled in the rough and tumble of the California gold fields or the bawdy and dangerous Barbary Coast District in San Francisco. These men also frequented the Comstock District in Nevada and were used to gambling against the hardened miners who populated these regions. The other faction in Tombstone, the Easterners, came from the east of the Pacific Slope and had dealt faro in Dodge City and the other cow towns of Kansas, as well as larger cities like Denver and St. Louis. Johnny Tyler was 41 years old when he landed in Tombstone. He had been born in Missouri, but raised by his father in the California gold fields before moving to Sacramento and then to the Barbary Coast. As a professional gambler for 20 years, he had seen and done it all before. In San Francisco, he was noted as a good-looking sport with black hair, a heavy mustache, piercing dark eyes, and a fondness for alcohol and swagger. He had shot and killed a fellow gambler in San Francisco during an ongoing disagreement, but was acquitted at trial. Seeking to clean his slate, he then operated a saloon and faro table in the fierce frontier town of Pioche, Nevada, before living the high life of a professional gambler in Virginia City. Tyler's return to San Francisco in the late 1870s had proved to be unwise, as the local police initiated a prolonged crackdown on faro dens. Tyler's place was cleaned out and shut down by police in May 1880. All his faro equipment and $1,300 of his money were confiscated during the raid, forcing him to look elsewhere for his action. He chose Tombstone and immediately eyed off the plush, newly opened Oriental gambling room. His goal was to open his own faro table or gambling room, but to do so, he needed to put a dent in the competition. Soon after opening, Milt Joyce and his partner suffered heavy losses in their Oriental gambling room, as professionals like Tyler had a run of good luck. Playing faro against the house was commonly referred to as bucking the tiger, as a popular playing card of the day featured an image of a tiger on the reverse side. The epitaph sarcastically commented that the newly arrived gamblers had skinned the tiger, but allowed Joyce and company to keep the hide. In an attempt to compete with the Oriental splendor, the Alhambra Saloon was renovated by its owner, Tom Corrigan. He too was eager to attract more gamblers to his three faro tables, but his efforts backfired soon after the reopening of the now Grand Alhambra gambling rooms. On the evening of September 21st, the available evidence suggests that Johnny Tyler was one of several professionals who took on the house and cleaned out their faro tables to the tune of $1,600. Corrigan put on a brave face, urging the professionals to return, stating, "If the boys want more sugar, they know where to find it." One of Corrigan's dealers, a former billiard champion named Tony Cracker, was drinking at Vogan's Saloon two nights later when he clashed heatedly with Tyler. Perhaps gloating over his recent victory at Cracker's faro table, the always aggressive Tyler went after the hapless dealer. Insults followed, and Cracker and Tyler pulled pistols, but were separated by onlookers before any shooting took place. Tyler was warming to his task. Back at the Oriental, Milt Joyce and his partner must have decided that running a gambling room was not as attractive as they had first thought. On October 1st, 1880, they kept the saloon, but leased the gambling room to the head of the Easterner faction, Louis Rickabaugh. He was a seasoned veteran of the gambling circuit, having operated in Denver and more recently in Hot Springs and Little Rock, Arkansas. He was a large, burly gent with deep pockets and a knack for forming mutually beneficial business associations. As soon as he took over, however, violence became a recurring theme at his faro tables. In the first week, two well-known yet unnamed gamblers caused a fight that resulted in a third party being bashed with a wooden faro case key. Battle lines seemed to be drawn, and Rickabaugh's rooms were singled out for attention. The following week, tubercular dentist Doc Holliday, another newly arrived Easterner, was frequenting the Oriental when he and Johnny Tyler had a disagreement that quickly escalated into threats of a shooting. Holliday was said to have challenged Tyler to a pistol duel, but the two were separated during an exchange of vile abuse. Milt Joyce asked both men to leave in peace. Tyler agreed, but the feisty Holliday returned to the scene, armed and angry at Joyce for interfering in his business. Holliday opened fire and shot Joyce in the hand and his partner in the foot before the wounded Joyce bashed the dentist into submission. Needless to say, Doc Holliday was no longer welcome at the Oriental, and Tyler was emboldened by the trouble he had helped to create. October 1880 was a busy month for Tyler. During the third week, he achieved one of his goals and opened his own faro table at the Danner and Owens Hall. But he was not finished causing trouble for the Oriental. Evidence suggests that on October 28th, he clashed there with another gambler known as Tex Hooker. Tyler appears to have been the aggressor, as he was fined $10 for disturbing the peace, while Hooker was found to have no case to answer. Rickabaugh needed to bolster his presence and put an end to the ongoing trouble. To do so, he partnered with two other high-stakes Easterner gamblers, Richard Clark and Dodge City's William Harris. This provided an injection of capital, and in turn, the powerful consortium employed William Bat Masterson and Luke Short as faro dealers at the Oriental. The Easterner faction were now a force to be reckoned with, and this may have prodded Tyler to seek his own reinforcements in the form of two hard-case slopers, Charlie Storms and Henry Dublin Lyons. Both men were violent gamblers who headquartered in San Francisco, where they knew Tyler, but traveled the West playing high-stakes faro in Tyler's other haunts, including Pioche and Virginia City, Nevada. They arrived in Tombstone early February 1881 and immediately singled out the Oriental gambling room to cause trouble. Reporting with the benefit of hindsight, the National Police Gazette thought their arrival in Tombstone was far from coincidental and flatly stated that Storms and Lyons were actually fighters for the slopers and had been imported to disrupt the Oriental and kill Luke Short. If that was actually their intent, it did not go according to plan. Storms became drunk and aggressive in the early hours of February 25th and began to abuse Rickabaugh, who wisely chose to leave quietly. Storms then turned to Luke Short, but the sober dealer warned him off. Later that day, Storms came back and called Short out for a duel in front of the Oriental. Short was too fast for him and put two bullets in Storm's chest, leaving him dead in the dust, while his shocked partner, Dublin Lyons, watched on in disbelief. After seeing to the burial of his partner, Lyons went back to the Oriental to finish the job Storms had started, but he was a man completely out of his depth. Evidence suggests Rickabaugh bashed Lyons in the head with a six-shooter and threw him out. Wyatt Earp, another former Dodge City man eager to join the Rickabaugh Consortium, then physically manhandled Lyons and ordered the defeated sloper to leave Tombstone. As another gambler noted, Lyons very quietly got up and dusted. Johnny Tyler's position now seemed untenable in Tombstone, but a further, seemingly unrelated killing at the Oriental on March 1, 1881, delivered him a reprieve and a bonus. Two gamblers had fought at a faro table, resulting in yet another death. Milt Joyce reached the end of his patience. He wanted no more violence associated with the Oriental, which was now being described as a regular slaughterhouse. Joyce took the drastic action of terminating Rickabaugh's lease and closing the entire saloon and gambling room for a month. This was the catalyst that saw William Harris, Bat Masterson, and Luke Short all to leave Tombstone, while Rickabaugh and Clark scouted for a new gambling venue. Much to Joyce's dismay, the owners of the block on which the Oriental stood then decided to add a second story to the building, and Rickabaugh, Clark, and a new partner, Wyatt Earp, leased the newly constructed premises for their own gambling rooms. They were in direct competition with Joyce, who was situated below them. The grand opening of the new Rickabaugh Club rooms, with the usual lavish furniture and plush fittings previously associated with the Oriental, occurred on June 11, 1881, and Johnny Tyler was still in Tombstone and was either envious of the new competition or simply wanted to break their bank, and he wasted no time. On the evening of June 19th, evidence suggests Tyler went to the new club rooms intent on causing trouble. Probably drunk, he sat down at Rickabaugh's faro table and unwisely began to abuse the owner. Wyatt Earp, now a partner, would not tolerate Tyler and immediately grabbed him and threw him down the stairs and out onto Allen Street. Earp bluntly told Tyler that he had a fighting interest in the new club rooms and ordered Tyler out of Tombstone. A San Francisco newspaper later confirmed that Johnny was smart enough to heed the warning. The Examiner reported that Tyler ran afoul of the Earps. He took a licking from some of them and allowed himself to be driven out of Tombstone. Tyler's exile ended the sloper Easterner hostilities in Tombstone, and he moved to Tucson for the next couple of months before relocating to Leadville, Colorado. But he was not quite done with yet, as fate would see him tangle once again with Doc Holliday in Leadville, and their old Tombstone enmities would violently resurface. Peter Brand is a researcher and author whose books include biographies of Texas Jack Vermillion of the Earp Vendetta Posse, and Doc Holliday's nemesis, The Story of Johnny Tyler and Tombstone's Gambler's War. For more on Brand's books, go to tombstonevendetta.com. Wyatt Earp, Is He Still a Hero? By True West Editors. Historians and writers share their perspectives on the West's most famous lawmen. In honor of the 140th anniversary of the gunfight near the OK Corral between the Earps and the Cowboys in Tombstone, Arizona Territory on October 26, 1881, we have asked fellow Earp historians, writers, novelists, artists, and friends to weigh in on the question, is Wyatt Earp still the hero? We have given True West's historian, Paul Andrew Hutton, the first word on the frontier marshal, and rightfully so. Wyatt Earp historian, artist, and executive director of True West, Bob Bowes Bell, will have the last. A Hero's Journey. 140 years after that perfectly named gunfight that made him famous, and 90 years after the publication of Stuart Lake's biography that ensured him immortality, Wyatt Earp remains firmly fixed in the pantheon of America's heroes. The tireless work of debunkers in history, fiction, and film has failed to tarnish the shiny star of the town-taming marshal who finally had to step outside the law to deliver true American gunpowder justice. The debunker's work has had scant impact on public perceptions, and of course, the sometimes sordid details of his life are far too deep in the weeds for most people to care about anyway. The latest Earpania, most notably the books by Casey Tieferteller and John Busenecker, and the films Wyatt Earp and Tombstone, starring Kevin Costner and Kurt Russell, have all cast Earp in a heroic mold. Earp's supreme moment of truth at the OK Corral has become part of the American lexicon, while also serving as the prototype for every Western showdown written about or filmed since October 26, 1881. Wyatt Earp was a late bloomer as a hero. While he was certainly well known on the frontier, especially in boom towns, on the gambling circuit, and as an all-around sporting man of some distinction, he was never remotely as famous as Davy Crockett, Kit Carson, Wild Bill Hickok, Jesse James, or Buffalo Bill Cody. The OK Corral fight was reported in the national press, but usually in a negative light as an example of uncivilized lawlessness in the West. Bat Masterson and Pat Garrett were far better known as frontier lawmen in their own time than Earp. The seed of Earp's fame was planted, fertilized, and carefully nurtured by Stuart Lake, a gifted writer who had once been a press agent for Theodore Roosevelt. Lake crafted a remarkable American epic in Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal, published by Houghton Mifflin in 1931. This was perfect timing, for the public was eager for tales of the American frontier, just as the generation that had won the West was dying off. Western histories by Walter Noble Burns, Emerson Hough, Frederick Beauchald, and William DeLoyd Rain had all recently done well, and Lake also enjoyed considerable success as his Earp biography became a bestseller and was serialized in the Saturday Evening Post. Lake's Earp was central to the frontier story. "The Old West cannot be understood unless Wyatt Earp is understood," he wrote. More than any other man of record in his time, possibly, he represented the exact combination of breeding and human experience which laid the foundations of Western empire. Thanks to Lake, Earp, the itinerant gambler and sometimes lawman, who lived rather precariously on the dark underbelly of frontier boomtown life, emerged as the towering legend of an incorruptible marshal who tamed the toughest towns in the West. Lake's book was optioned by Fox Studio for $7,500 and was filmed four times: Frontier Marshal with George O'Brien in 1934, Frontier Marshal with Randolph Scott in 1939, My Darling Clementine with Henry Fonda in 1946, and Powder River with Rory Calhoun in 1953. Over 40 films have been based on Earp's career, and Hollywood has played the critical role in creating and sustaining his glossy legend. Lake's book also provided the inspiration for the ABC television series starring Hugh O'Brien that premiered in 1955. The life and legend of Wyatt Earp ran for six seasons, and its success helped initiate a decade-long period during which Westerns dominated the small screen. In a snide 1959 article on the Western TV boom, Time magazine noted that the real Earp was a hard-headed businessman, less interested in law and order than he was in a fast buck. The success of the show, Time attributed less to history than to O'Brien's muscles and square jaw. Actor O'Brien, real name Hugh Crimp, looks like an Oklahoma Oliver. In his flowered vest, ruffled shirt, string tie, and sideburns, and with two 16-inch bunt line specials strapped to his thighs. He really cuts the mustard with the teenage cow bunnies. This television white knight was ripe for debunking, and Ed Barthelmuehl and Frank Waters promptly obliged. Their IRP, a con artist and ruthless killer who hid behind a badge, was copied by a string of lesser talented researchers and writers. Waters, a distinguished Western writer, was a caustic forerunner of the current woke generation. His attack on IRP was also meant to deconstruct the frontier myth of American progress and exceptionalism that he blamed for many of the planet's problems. The source of all these ills, according to Waters, was America's only true morality play, the Cowboy and Indians movie thriller, the basis of our tragic national psychosis, a fixation against all dark-skinned races, beginning with the red, which was killed off, and carrying on through to the black, which was enslaved, the brown, legally discriminated against, and the yellow, excluded by legislation. Waters felt that if only he could dismantle the heroic IRP legend, he could begin to destroy the whole frontier narrative. Lake's IRP was central to his task. This veritable Wild West textbook, the source of other books, pulp paper yarns, movie thrillers galore, radio serials, a national TV series, Wyatt Earp hats, vests, toy pistols, tin badges, a fictitious legend of preposterous proportions. In two books, The Colorado in 1946 and The Earp Brothers of Tombstone in 1960, Waters attempted to bring down the Earp legend and the American frontier story that it was such an integral part of. Waters failed in his own time to destroy the heroic story of the frontier movement, but his writing foreshadowed the so-called New Western history that would come to dominate college classrooms a generation later. That dark vision of the American past, in turn, spread to public schools across the nation. The result is the bitter debate over our shared history that dominates public discourse today. While the gentleman on Mount Rushmore targeted for cancellation, it may be that Wyatt Earp is low enough on the totem pole of American heroes to escape attention, but do not count on it. If he does raise the ire of the woke mob, it will not be in response to the reality of his life, but rather to the frothy legend so lovingly constructed by Stuart Lake and his posse of fellow travelers in Hollywood. Heroes are but a reflection of beliefs and aspirations of those who embrace them. People identify with heroes, and as our society evolves and changes, old heroes are often replaced by new figures. But some characters are so great that they have resisted change. These heroic figures, from the time of Homer's tales of Greek and Trojan warriors to the last stand of the Spartans, from the legends of King Arthur and El Cid to the battles between Richard the Lionheart and Saladin, to the forests, mountains, and plains of the New World, where the names of Boone, Crockett, Carson, and Cody would become legendary alongside of their foes, Tichmouth, Red Eagle, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and Geronimo, have all shaped national identity. Our heroes define us. If these hero tales, no matter the truth of them, are rejected, it indeed makes a powerful statement and can erode any sense of national unity. Is Wyatt Earp still a hero? Time will tell. Note, actually, the Time author was incorrect. O'Brien's Earp was armed with one 16-inch buntline special and one normal-length Colt revolver. By Paul Andrew Hutton. Wyatt, a hero? I can hardly hear you. Josephine is hollering at me. William Shakespeare is yelling something about tragic flaws. But the ghost of Lincoln Ellsworth is whispering yes. Anne Kirshner. The real Wyatt was certainly a man of physical courage, as were many people of the Western frontier, but it's the other half of the definition that's the harder test, the part about being a person of high moral principles, and the answer is sadly no, unless you consider things like frequenting bordellos, gambling, and killing your enemies to be high moral behavior. neither in his time nor in ours would those things be considered principled activities. So although his real adventures make for a good story, they do not reveal true heroism. In the total sense of the word, it took novels and Hollywood to make a hero out of Wyatt Earp. Victoria Wilcox. I think he was a pimp, a thief, and a killer. Michael Byne. I would say Wyatt Earp was a brave man who did what he thought he had to do. He was certainly flawed and did many questionable things in his life, such as pimping, horse theft, gambling, and bunco. So not heroic, but certainly brave, and someone I would want by my side in a fight. Peter Brand. I have long felt the film Ride the High Country is a film about the battle waged for Wyatt Earp's soul. Joel McRae had portrayed Wyatt Earp in Wichita, 1955, and Randolph Scott had portrayed Earp in Frontier Marshal, 1939. 2 years before Sam Peckinpah's second film was released, Frank Waters' The Earp Brothers of Tombstone was published. So, at the time Ride the High Country was in production, there were two decidedly different takes on Wyatt in print. Stuart Lake presented Wyatt the Good, while Frank Waters presented Wyatt the Bad. In the Peckinpah film, McRae plays a lawman of high principle, Wyatt the Good. Scott plays a former lawman who has taken to exaggerating his exploits and who is not above breaking the law to increase his wealth, Wyatt the Bad. There are hints in the film that Wyatt is being dealt with in the film's story. First, the Earps are mentioned by McRae. Seeing a banner that claims Scott had cleaned up Dodge City, McRae says, "I don't know you ran with the Earps." Then the final gunfight is obviously based on the OK Corral shooting. When Warren Oates yells out, "Start the ball, old man," to start the shooting, he is echoing Ike Clanton, who on the day of the OK Corral shooting said, "The ball will open when Holiday and the Earps appear on the street." So while the film tells the story of the conflicts in Wyatt Earp's soul, by extension, it is also covering the conflicts in the soul of America, a nation conflicted by noble ideals on one hand and unprincipled opportunism on the other hand. Jeff Morey. Humans need heroes. All great heroes are flawed, both real and mythical. Samson, Hercules, King Arthur, Frodo, Mickey Mantle, the Duke, Patton, Reagan, and Wyatt Earp. A hero is just someone who does the right and necessary thing at the right time, even if it's not always for the right reason. Yes, Wyatt is still a hero. Lydia O'Rafter. Wyatt Earp to me has never been either a hero or a villain, but a complex individual with some admirable qualities and flaws. Pretty much like any other gun-toting historical figure on the frontier. The contradictions that partly come out of the legend portrayals and differing perspectives are very interesting to me. Most Earp aficionados have no objections to his going on a rampage during his vendetta ride and pitilessly gunning down men in vengeance. I have no problems with it either. But why has it always been seen as okay for Earp to do that? But Bonnie and the Regulators are routinely condemned for their own vendetta ride in the spring of 1878 when they gunned down Morton, Baker, Brady, and Hindman to avenge a brutal murder. I fail to see the distinction between the two courses of action. What, because Brady wore a badge? Please. So did John Selman, for Christ's sake. James B. Mills. So is Wyatt Earp a hero? In this writer's opinion, he meets the criteria. By virtue of his actions and what his story did for one of my favorite places in the world, the town too tough to die, Tombstone. Randy Lee O'Neill. So he was friendly with whores. So was Jesus. So Earp clobbered people with pistols. So did Hunter S. Thompson. So he was a Republican. So was John McCain. Heck, your question takes me by surprise, as if it had been written by an associate professor of woke studies. Red Shuttleworth. To me, a hero is someone who saves lives, not someone who takes them. Jesus hung out with prostitutes to save them, not because he was their pimp. Wyatt was doing a job. That doesn't make him a hero. Larry Willis. During the last three decades, an enormous amount of material has been dug out to better illustrate Wyatt Earp and the Tombstone Saga. Some may seem to tarnish Earp. Some may seem to enhance his reputation. Together, it shows that Wyatt Earp was never the stainless hero created by legend-making writers and filmmakers. Very few historical figures can live up to their legends. With Earp, the more we learn, the more interesting he becomes. He certainly had his personal flaws, but when the time came to stand tall, tall he stood. The Tombstone story is really about what happens when outlawry grows out of control and how a community responds. It resonates today as it did 14 decades ago. When that challenge came to Wyatt Earp, he responded with remarkable courage. If that is the test of heroism, then he passed with nobility. Casey Tieferteller. Wyatt Earp has long been known to students of the Old West as an itinerant frontier gambler whose entire law enforcement career lasted only 7 years. Then, during the past two decades, a great deal of previously unknown information about Wyatt has surfaced. For many historians and Western buffs, he has since evolved from the Lion of Tombstone to the Pimp of Peoria. Nonetheless, of all the adventures and misadventures in Earp's life, his epic battle against the cowboys in Arizona Territory made him a hero, then and now. In 1881-1882, Wyatt, his brothers, and a handful of loyal friends took on and defeated the biggest outlaw gang of the Old West. It was the highlight of his life and remains one of the most remarkable incidents in the history of American law enforcement. John Bosenecker. Directly after the shocking assassination of President James Garfield, Tombstone City Management government enacted zero-tolerance gun control ordinances. On October 26, 1881, City Marshal Virgil Earp was ordered by Mayor John Clum to disarm men seen carrying weapons inside city limits. Those men were at the OK Corral because they were leaving town and they had the right to take their guns with them. But the confrontation accelerated within moments. The officers were later exonerated using legal logic that protects police in officer-involved shootings to this day. They reacted quickly to a perceived threat in a pressured situation. Where's the heroism? Wyatt never claimed it. He was dogged for the rest of his lone life by the worst 30 seconds of it. After he died, his widow took control of his posthumous reputation, insisting that Stuart Lake write the hagiography that became a TV show, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp. I can still sing the theme song, but the West was not lawless, and no man is flawless. I look for my heroes elsewhere. Mary Doria Russell. Wyatt Earp, frontier lawman, gambler, outlaw, Western legend, an icon whose reputation, justified or not, has been created and enhanced through literature, films, and television. Justified by some, vilified by others. Loyal, vengeful, complicated, egotistical, arrogant, passionate, moody, stoic. Before you develop your opinion, however, forget the film and television. They are just entertainment, and in most cases, highly fictionalized. Read the books, plural. Some well-researched, others not so. Then make up your mind. All Wyatt wanted to do in life, as with many, was to take advantage of the situation and do what he thought was right. John Farkas. I'm not sure if Wyatt ever deserved the hero designation. The Earps, as a family, were shameless opportunists who never took a stand without a buck being attached to it. The celebrated gunfight was the culmination of a petty political squabble that had little impact on the outcome of American history. Like so many legends, a local affair blown all to hell out of proportion. Unimportant and irrelevant, especially at a time when a new generation of learners fail to find themselves in the prevailing narrative. Kirk Ellis. I don't think of Wyatt Earp as a hero. The very premise of a good guy's bad guy's approach to history distorts the humanity of the individuals so labeled and the issues that they confronted. Honestly, I can't even call him a good man, given his checkered career and flaws of character. But he was respected and even admired by good men who saw in him qualities they envied. He lived for 81 years, and the violent moment for which he is best remembered lasted less than 30 seconds. Add the few months of the vendetta and the deaths that came with it, and he was still a better man than those he killed. Gary L. Roberts. Wyatt Earp matters because of what he means, not for who he really was. Tom Ross. Wyatt Earp will always be my hero. Sure, he wasn't a saint, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Paul Holan. I don't look at Wyatt Earp as either a hero or a villain. Projecting our own mores and values on people of another time leads to false perceptions and a warped view of history. He was a man of his time, doing what seemed right by his own lights. Doc McClandis. It's easy to get bogged down in the weeds with someone like Wyatt Earp. Is he a hero? Sure. A villain? Probably. He embodies everything we Americans like about ourselves, our history, and our so-called great men, and everything we don't like, too. There's a little dirt on most American heroes, and Wyatt Earp is no exception. Samuel K. Dolan. Although Wyatt Earp demonstrated toughness and bravery, he was really only out for himself and his family. Greg Scott. It's doubtful that any American has had any more of his legend turned into fact than Wyatt Earp, who had a brief career as a frontier peace officer and scarcely wore a badge over the last 48 years of his life. Before and after lawing, as it was called in the 19th century, Earp was a teamster, boxing referee, prospector, buffalo hunter, racehorse owner, croupier, stagecoach guard, bouncer, saloon keeper, bodyguard, Hollywood movie advisor, and for a while, before he became a noted lawman in Kansas, a pimp. He's been portrayed by more actors than any American president. Walter Huston, Henry Fonda, Burt Lancaster, Hugh O'Brien, James Stewart, James Garner, Kurt Russell, and Kevin Costner, to name just a few. But the only years Hollywood has taken notice of are those spent in the cow towns of Wichita and Dodge City, Kansas, and the silver mining camp, Tombstone, Arizona. What happened over that brief span has engendered enough books to fill a small library. Alan Barra. Having grown up on such TV staples as The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin and The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, when my family planned to relocate to Arizona, I couldn't wait. Not long after arriving, we made the pilgrimage to Tombstone. Strapping on my pair of cap guns, I expected a showdown there with Hugh O'Brien. Alas, I never faced his buntline special. More than 65 years have passed. Since then, most of us have a far different perspective on the marshal of The Town Too Tough to Die. Stuart Lake's fanciful biography, early television and movies, have been replaced by scores of factual articles, documentaries, and tomes of various size and quality, toppling the Earps from their pedestals. As a historian, I appreciate such scholarly efforts, but the five-year-old in me wants to see if I could beat O'Brien's lightning draw. John Langelier. I've been studying Wyatt for more than 70 years. I first became interested in 1946 when Henry Fonda played him in My Darling Clementine. I saw him made larger than life by Hugh O'Brien. Then I watched his character debauched in that sorry 1960s film Doc, a time when it was cool to tarnish heroes. I briefly let myself be influenced by Frank Waters' The Earp Brothers of Tombstone. Over the past 20 years with True West, I had the good fortune to meet and read writers like Casey Tieferteller, Jeff Morey, Doc Roberts, and John Bosenecker. They are not just good writers, but researchers extraordinaire. Wyatt Earp was a sporting man, much like his peers. He had flaws, don't we all? But he was a strong character, head and shoulders above those who tried to take him down in Tombstone. He is best described by what Louis L'Amour called a good man to ride the river with, Marshall Trimble. I emphatically say yes. Although he was human and had his flaws, as do we all, and as so eagerly elucidated by many modern-day authors who have picked apart the minutiae of his life in every way possible, he must be judged by the morals of his time, not by modern-day ideals. There is absolutely no question that he and his brothers were exceptionally brave men and not to be trifled with. Even the harshest of his critics must admit that. When I think of Wyatt, I think of his 1896 quote, "He is like a sheepdog, feared by the flock and hated by the wolves." And then try to imagine if I could muster the courage to take a stand against superior odds as he had done so many times in his lifetime. Sadly, I fear not. Could you? David DeHaas. He was never a hero to me. Wyatt Earp was a fascinating frontier figure, with some bad spells mixed with some strong leadership. From Kansas to California, Arizona to Alaska to Nevada, he was a presence. In those eras, he was someone to consider. At the faro tables of Tombstone, the mining claims of Idaho, or the Dexter Saloon in Nome, Wyatt Earp was given more consideration than other folks. Hero worship? Not necessarily. This was just being smart. The novels, movies, and television presentations may have exaggerated parts of his career, but in the day, wherever he was, Wyatt Earp mattered. Don Chaput. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Wyatt Earp. Well, at least Hugh O'Brien's version of him. I wanted to be brave, courageous, and bold, and wear cool Western clothing. But I grew up, got into the Old West field, and discovered that the real Wyatt Barry Stapp Earp was not all the small screen cracked him up to be. I came to know researchers who dug up the dirt, the pimping, the cons, the gambling, etc., etc. And lo and behold, this flesh and blood Wyatt became ever more interesting than the cardboard cutout hero. And maybe that's the important thing. I have few heroes when it comes to the Old West, men or women who I aspire to be like. Wyatt Earp sure isn't one, but I could study him, read about him, even digest the popular culture image of him for days on end. Mark Boardman. I'm glad to admit that Wyatt Earp is one of my two favorite Old West characters, along with Comanche Jack Stillwell. I love the whole Wyatt Earp history. Hero? I don't know in what regard we might use that term for Wyatt. Lake, Burns, and other writers did a pretty good job of putting Wyatt in that light, as did the 1950s TV show and movies such as Tombstone. However, with the advent of the internet and historic newspaper websites, we've learned a good bit about Wyatt that has put him in a less than heroic light. Documented history often changes one's perspective from previously held opinions. However, I've never had a hero who didn't have feet of clay. Wyatt did, and so did virtually every other lawman of the Old West. Wyatt's story is the one that keeps us going. Long may his story be told. Roy B. Young. The Last Word. When I was 10, Wyatt Earp was my hero. He could do no wrong, and, like the song said, I believed he was flawless. Then a series of historical breakthroughs changed everything. Wyatt Earp is now relegated to the trash heap of history. So pronounced two prominent historians who had uncovered evidence in 1959 that Wyatt Earp's second wife, who he had abandoned, had turned to prostitution and committed suicide with an overdose of laudanum. Oh, and on her deathbed, she was quoted as saying, "Wyatt Earp ruined my life." And then it got worse. But let's go back to the beginning of the myth-making process. Thanks to authors Walter Noble Burns and Stuart Lake, Wyatt Earp basically came out of nowhere in the 1930s, and after this initial discovery period, he had this huge renaissance when Stuart Lake sold the Earp as Super Lawman idea to TV, and we got the Hugh O'Brien TV show in the mid-1950s. This image held solid until researchers, like historians John Gilcrease and Frank Waters, started turning up murky and even more shady aspects of his life, full of scandalous and sordid, edgy and violent aspects, writ large for the consumption of a very unwoke audience. A Pimp's Progress. Then came even more damning evidence when it was discovered that Wyatt Earp had been a bouncer on a floating Bagnio whorehouse in Peoria, Illinois, at the time he claimed he was hunting buffalo on the plains, and that the census for 1872 appears to show him living in a bordello. Of course, we already knew that later in Dodge City, several soiled doves went by the name of Earp. But this really put Wyatt in the camp of the procurers, not a nice place for a legendary, flawless lawman. Perhaps what we choose to believe about him says more about us than it does him. I, for one, no longer think of him as a hero, but I still admire his guts. But the most wonderful part of the effort to seek the truth has been meeting the fellow buffs and historians who study this history and try to make sense of it every day. That has been the true reward for me. So thank you, Wyatt Earp, for bringing me together with some pretty brilliant and humorous people. My current take. From my perspective today, I see Wyatt Earp in the late 1920s, trying to get his story told to vindicate his felonious actions in the tombstone part of his life. It was a mere 22 months of his long life. He didn't want to necessarily become a heroic do-gooder, but that was ultimately in the cards. Stuart Lake took care of that. From there, a crooked town, Hollywood, spun out a crooked fable that has spanned the globe. Equal parts hype, nostalgia, and human longing, the old lawman stands tall, and, at least on film, he vanquishes all his enemies. The facts be damned. Bob Bowes Bell. Quote, I will not say that all of the people in the motion picture industry are crooks, but I will say that all the crooks in Hollywood are in the motion picture industry. Zane Grey.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.